So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. Today we discuss facts and death. Yes, we depart from the usual format to bring you two fascinating interviews. We have Mivan Babakar and Phoebe Arnold from Full Fact to discuss fact-checking and its role in the digital age. And later, we'll be speaking to the obituaries editor of The Times, Simon Pearson, on the art of writing the last word. That's coming up on today's Media Podcast. To start the show, in this world of claim and counterclaim, where journalism is underfunded and there's a growing distrust of politicians and the mainstream media, where does one turn for verifiable truth? Full Fact is an independent charity who've given themselves the mission to fact-check public figures, broadcasters, and the press. Mivan Babakar and Phoebe Arnold join me now. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Now, you launched in 2010... which, looking back on it now, feels like a golden age of truth and decency, pre-fake news as we know it now. Why did you launch 7 years ago?
Okay, so it's not so much the date, but there were fact-checking organisations in the US called PolitiFact and FactCheck.org.
Uh-huh.
And Peter Oborn, who used to work for The Telegraph, he wrote a book called The Rise of Political Lying. And in it, he said there's a burning need for fact-checkers like they have in the US, in the UK. At roughly the same time, Honora O'Neill was talking a lot about trust and transparency in the media. She did these really good Reith lectures, I think in 2002, where she said that our ambition is not to place trust blindly, as small children do, but to trust claims using information. And so we need information to judge the claims that we hear. Now, our director, Will Moy, was working in the House of Lords at the time for a crossbench peer called Lord Low. And he was seeing a lot of briefings coming in from lobby groups, and inaccurate claims in those were making it into parliamentary debates and sometimes even into legislation.
Yeah.
And so he kind of put all these three things together and came up with the idea for Full Fact.
I mean, unquestionably, we live in a world where press releases make it to air. I mean, I've been guilty of that myself when I've been sent a press release at 11 p.m. and I'm about to go on air at 1 in the morning and it fits perfectly with what I'm about to talk about and there's no one to call. On the other hand, I've always felt, as a broadcaster, not even a journalist as such, that it's my responsibility to at least have an air of scepticism about those facts. And you would hope that journalists who are working for the print media, it's part of their training to do fact-checking. So isn't the creation of an organisation like yours an admission that something's going wrong? Shouldn't instead people have said, let's train our journalists better?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And funnily enough, when our first fact-checker gave his notice, his boss said, oh, fact checkers, we used to have those. So I think you're completely right. And I suppose maybe it's partly down to the struggling finances of a lot of media operations, where even though they may have a desire to check facts, they don't necessarily have the resources. And that's something that we get a lot of requests for, particularly during the election and the referendum last year. I think we had something like 69 requests for briefings and interviews. And that was stuff that was kind of on the record. And then apart from that, we had lots of citations. So people kind of definitely use us as a resource, as much as we're also holding journalists and politicians to account.
And I guess, Mivan, you're actually competing with the promotions industry, aren't you, with PR, and there's more money behind that. We all know how that works. You know, you're a tin food company. You go to the PR company, you say, we want a stat that says 8 out of 10 cats prefer our product. You know, and then they make it true. There's no real way of checking those facts unless you're the people who did the research in the first place.
Yeah, and that's why we also call for people who make claims in the public domain to actually also release that information, especially at least when it's government that makes those claims. If you're going to come out and say that we've put government money towards for doing this research and we're not going to publish it openly, but we are going to tell you what that research led to, and this is our big new headline claim that we're going to plaster across the country, we need to give people the research and tools to be able to judge that claim for themselves and judge that research for themselves.
So how does your organisation work then on a daily basis? What's it actually like working for you?
Normally we have someone who comes in, looks at the news, picks out claims that they think are interesting to our audience or might surprise our audience if we fact check them. Claims,
and who is your audience?
It's people who work professionally in politics and journalism. And then what we call the kind of political junkies, so people who follow journalism, like some people follow football, and maybe they kind of see our fact checks almost as a way to kind of get one up on their friends. Mm. And then the last kind of broad and vague category is, I guess, people who are interested in issues, so the NHS or benefits or immigration.
This might seem like a naive question because in a way it's obvious, you just look for the facts, but it's never that simple in politics, is it? How do you approach a subject with genuinely no bias, no prejudice? Because you take a subject like immigration, you've got Migration Watch, for example, who clearly have an agenda, but then clearly also have the promise that they're trying to present facts. I mean, all these organisations that have a bias have their own fact-checking teams too.
Mm-hmm. You're right. It's really hard. Yeah. We have quite a lot of structures in place. So first of all, our recruitment process, we do a lot of tests on people to kind of see how they talk about politics, and we try and judge whether they have any sensitivity towards the whole idea of neutrality or whether they're just so biased that they don't even realize they're being biased.
And actually, quite interestingly, we find that historians make really great fact checkers, which we didn't know when we first started out, but we've hired a lot of them. And that's, I think, probably because you can hold lots of information in your head, number one, but also lots of different interpretations of information. Mm. And having that ability to interpret facts and figures in different ways with different sensitivities is actually really important to fact checking.
But I mean, if you're trying to aid the viewer or the listener to come to a decision about an important story, I sometimes think as a presenter on these shows, you know, when the fact-checking person comes on, really what that person's doing is they're saying, yeah, what you've just heard is simplistic and actually the truth is nuanced.
Yep.
But the audience just get that gist. They get is the gist that it's complicated. But yeah, it doesn't actually help them. It doesn't tell them, yes, it's true or no, it's false. It actually can muddy the water a bit for some of those viewers and listeners.
Yeah, I think this is a problem that we struggle with, and definitely fact-checkers all around the world struggle with, is the kind of boring refrain of, oh, actually, I think you'll find it's more complicated. But one thing that's a kind of big topic of contention is the idea of using ratings. And one of the reasons we don't use those, whereas a lot of fact checkers do, is because we don't like telling people what to think. We see it as our role to give them the information to judge what they're hearing. And that's why we're kind of looking more and more at education work, so educating in schools and universities and in journalism classrooms and that kind of thing. Like, we can't fact check all the claims, so we need to teach other people to do it for themselves.
But also, the world is complex, like, and lots of people are painting it as black and white too often. And our job is to add in all the shades of grey. And unfortunately, that is saying it's complex and giving people a more nuanced view of the world, but that's because it better reflects the world.
And would you like to see more penalties for particularly political parties that do take it further than the data says? And I'm thinking back to the referendum campaign here in the battle bus claim. The one thing that I heard time and again from all the fact-checking organisations was what they've written on the battle bus isn't true in terms of the amount that would be saved from the EU because of all the complicated reasons we won't go into here. But that was a simplistic number.
Yeah.
And that question was put to Nigel Farage and it was put to Boris Johnson and they deflected it. Should there be some sort of legislation that prevents them from saying it in the first place?
I think that's probably something for politicians to hash out. But I do think it's incredible that the leaflet put through everyone's door by the Electoral Commission wasn't reviewed for accuracy. We found quite a lot of mistakes in that. And I just find it so surprising that basically you can give out information that's not correct and that's publicly funded.
It happened on both sides, by the way. It wasn't just the Vote Leave campaign. Remain also put out a lot of inaccurate information in that same
Or exaggerated. Yeah.
Talk to me about your role with social media companies now, because Facebook have finally admitted that more needs to be done in terms of fake news across social networks.
Definitely. And that's really welcome. And the fact that they're talking to people outside of their own company is really great. But I do think there's quite a long way to go. So probably the main thing that people will have heard about is this third-party fact-checking pilot, which they're doing in the US and Germany and France. And I think the idea with that is that users can flag fake news stories, URLs only, not memes or pictures, which I would like them to add into that pilot. And then fact checkers get access to that data. And then when a user tries to share a story that's been fact checked by fact checkers, although not all of them are necessarily nonpartisan ones, in my opinion, you'll get a kind of box saying this has been flagged as possibly disputed by fact checkers. Mm. And do you want to continue to share it? So that's kind of their first attempt from a fact-checking point of view at helping users to understand when they're seeing fake news. But I do think it would be really good to see some data about how many stories are being flagged and how well the scheme is actually working. At the moment, we don't have that, so we can't really see whether it's a success or not.
It's also not running in the UK yet, which is the key thing to say.
Yep.
And we're not involved in it. But what we are involved in with Facebook is the release of these top 10 tips. I'm not saying top 10, they're just 10 tips, and they're good
and
tips.
What are your 10 tips?
For example, being skeptical of headlines, they don't always necessarily match up to the story.
Right, so they're tips for readers of how to identify fake news.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, check the URL, find the evidence, how do they know these things,
like
check
all the
photos.
Basics,
yeah,
that people listening to this will know, but that not everyone always thinks about.
And actually, Phoebe, when you said you'd like to see memes and pictures included, the obvious example that sprang to my mind then with Sean Spicer's Alternative Facts was the photo of the Obama inauguration as a meme split down the middle with a picture of the Trump inauguration and the amount of people that were on what do they call it in the States? Is that the Mall? I don't know.
Yeah,
whatever.
I think
the,
so, yeah.
The big road in Washington at the inauguration. That was a meme that went everywhere.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of thing where you'd want Facebook to analyze it and say, yes, that is an accurate representation of both events?
Imagine if that had been flagged as dubious to all those people who shared it. Mm. Wouldn't that be great?
It's about stopping the spread of misinformation more than it is anything else, right? It's if something is wrong before it proliferates across the whole of the internet and everyone shared it to their friends and misled their family and everything, like shared it with, I don't know, their community groups. It's really important that we at least give these people the chance to correct it and to stop it moving.
And so what's the future on this? I get the sense, Maivan, this is your department. Automated fact-checking?
Yes, which is
a shiver down the spine.
Yes, it's a scary term.
Ridley Scott type. go on.
And it's not actually necessarily very descriptive of what it is. The great thing about the nature of public debate is that everybody repeats themselves. Politicians and campaigners repeat themselves. So inevitably, a fact-checker will eventually, or a journalist, will have a story written about that main claim that is going around the internet. So it's about how can you take that claim one time, do the fact check, but also then spot every single instance of it repeated. Take the 350 million claim, for example. We fact checked it very early on in the campaign, but that fact check wasn't side by side with every single instance of it online. So we're building tools that monitors the media, monitors TV subtitles, monitors everything said in Parliament, and then flags every time misinformation is repeated. And that will help us scale and target our work better. It will help us quantify our own effect in the world a bit as well. Like, did that intervention, did that correction actually mean there were fewer instances of that claim eventually? Yeah, it lets us do more with a team of 11, basically.
Maivan Babacar and Phoebe Arnold. For more on what they do, head to fullfact.org. Coming next, how to write an obit for The Times.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership.
Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Now, obituary writers have been rather busy of late. Kerry Fisher, Prince, Muhammad Ali. It seems as the world's baby boomers reach a certain age, every week seems to bring with it news of another dead celeb. The obituaries editor of The Times is Simon Pearson, originating from a small mining town in North Nottinghamshire, not exactly a hotbed of journalism. He set his sights on a career as a hack from the age of 11, when a family friend travelled to Vietnam to cover the after effects of the war. After studying journalism, Simon worked his way up from the Mansfield Chronicle Advertiser to become night editor at The Times, and now on to his current position. So, with so many big names seemingly dying all the time, how does he choose who to write about?
There are the great and the good, and the really famous who you have to cover. Everyone knows them, whether it's the Queen, or whether it's a former Prime Minister, or whether it's a very well-known actor, or whether it's one of your top QCs. And then you've got a huge range of people, some of whom automatically come onto your radar because people phone up. They put their names in the death notices, and they are pretty well-known in their sphere. Mm. And you commission those obituaries.
So sometimes people phone up, and do they pay to put a death notice in?
Yes, the death notice is a sort of small classified advert in which they announce the death of somebody. And often you find out about quite prominent people through the death notices.
And that alerts you to it?
Yes.
What are you looking for when you're looking at your own death notices, thinking, there's a story there?
Well, there are two things. You're looking for relatively well-known people whose deaths have not been announced on radio, television, in the news pages of the newspapers. And you're looking for interesting lives, a hint of a story. Because after all, obituaries are not just about recognising the recently dead. It's about entertaining the readers with colourful stories of people's lives. I mean, one of the most important things we consider when weighing up whether to carry an obituary or not is, was this person interesting? And whereas once upon a time, I think judges, generals, air marshals and MPs automatically got an obituary, that's not the case. If someone's been an MP for a long time, but actually are not very interesting, we'll say, well, let's not bother. So there's a change going on.
And when you say you're looking for a story, so what makes you prick up your ears? What are the kind of details that you think, aha?
I think operating in oddball areas of life, well, it's a bit like you and your podcast, looking for people from sort of different areas of endeavour, which are going to interest your readers because they don't know very much about them. For example, I think a few years ago we came across a chap on a council estate in Redditch who was making the finest fly fishing rods in the world and making probably no more than 15 or 20 a year. And, you know, some of the very rich businessmen from Japan, etc., would come through this council estate to his back room and choose a rod. Most unusual. And he made a good story. So you're looking for people who have a different story to tell.
And how do you tell that story? Because that's not one you can research easily using the internet, is it? That's not one you can even find
You come across them by accident. I think with that one, we had a keen fisherman who had bought a rod off him. and heard he had died and thought we ought to know about it. And so, and it was probably 2 or 3 weeks after he had died, and he phoned us and said, I think you should look at this chap. And of course we did.
Okay, so how did you end up being the obituaries editor?
Right. I'd been essentially a senior editor on the Times for a long time, 25 years or so, and I wrote a book. It was the biography of a man called Roger Bushell. And Roger Bushell was a big X on The Great Escape. I had been interested in him since I was a little boy, since my dad took me to see the film at the ABC cinema in Mansfield and then bought me Paul Brickhill's book of The Great Escape, I think the following Christmas or something like that. And I had this incredible sort of interest in this man for years and years and years and researched nuggets, etc. And then I had this amazing breakthrough. I went for lunch with Ben McIntyre, who's a well-known author and works for the Times, and I told him what I knew about this man, and he just said, you have got to get on with this book instead of just talking about it. I wrote to the Imperial War Museum, and this was in the autumn of 2011, having nurtured this story for a very long time, and I got a response that was really quite surprising. They wrote back and said, we can help you. The family of Roger Bushell, who lived in South Africa, have been in touch with us in the past few weeks, wanting to donate his archive to the museum, the Imperial War Museum. And
fortuitous.
Incredibly fortuitous. And say, do you want to be put in touch? So I was put in touch, and I got on with them, and they gave me access to Roger Bushell's archive letters, etc. And the Imperial War Museum got involved and commissioned me to write a book, which I did. That was what I was planning to do anyway. So anyway, I wrote this book about Roger Bushell, and I spoke at Cheltenham. And at about the same time, that's the Cheltenham Literary Festival, and at about the same time, the Times had a change of editor, and the new editor was looking for somebody to take over the Register, the obituary section. I think as a result of the book I'd written, and obviously my interest in biographies, he thought that I might be worth a chance. And I'd been night editor for a very, very long time. So it was probably time for a change. And so by those fortuitous circumstances, in many respects, I had a new career on the Times. And a very interesting one. Probably in some ways the most unusual obit we have run, which nobody else ran, was Lord Lucan. Mm. And we ran him last year, the beginning of last year, after the courts had ruled that he was dead. Yeah. You know, nobody's found a body, nobody knows where he is. Generally, it's not known what happened to him. But his family sought a ruling from the courts. And once they'd done that, we published his obituary, and we'd commission it some weeks beforehand. I think it was one of the most compelling reads. It was beautifully done, very cleverly done, and was probably unexpected. It brought together everything that everybody knew, but it took everyone through the events, and I think painted a rich picture of him, which maybe was not altogether known. And therefore, I think it did add something to the Lucan story.
So let's talk about that other category of people, the really famous people.
Oh, yeah.
Presumably there's a store, is there? So that if Prince Philip dropped dead today, there's an obituary ready to go. How often does that get updated?
There is an obituary of Prince Philip ready to go. And the current version was written last year. Just as there is an obituary of the Queen, and that was first written in the early 1950s, was updated again last year in the aftermath of the last big celebration, which was the Diamond Jubilee, I think. So we're continually updating obituaries of that kind. I think also styles change under the current editor of the Times, John Witherow. He wants far more anecdotes, far more colour and insights into the family. So we have to take the stock obits we've got. We've got about 5,000
wow.
or so that have been built up over 60 years or more. Most of them when it comes to publication, need rewriting or editing very heavily. And it's very rare that you can go into the library, pull out an obituary and put it straight in the paper. You're not dealing so much with death, but celebrating life. You're celebrating someone's achievements, telling the story of usually a successful life, or at least in part a successful life, where people have achieved great things in their lives. I think when you're writing a feature article about someone in this respect, call it an obituary, you're researching a life, a biography, it's fascinating, and I don't think you dwell on the death, so to speak. But there are times, I think, particularly when people die young, there are some very sad stories, or have been very sad stories, of people who have gone young, and you find out a lot about them and their families and everything, and I think it does touch on you. One of the things which strikes me as an individual more than anything else is the number of people who loomed so large in my childhood in the late 50s and 60s, the sort of television stars. Television was coming into, very much coming into its own there, and the pop stars of the day, everything, who regularly feature on our obituaries pages now. Mm-hmm. I find that quite a moment when I get my sort of flashback to being a child. And it happens quite regularly because events and personalities that loomed so large then are coming through the pages I edit.
It's a way that people measure out their own life, isn't it? I mean, you saw that really clearly, I think, with Bowie's death last year, that for a lot of baby boomers or people born just after that,
yes,
there's someone who was younger than them,
yes,
who was cooler than them,
yes,
who died.
Yes. It was an incredible reaction to Bowie's death, probably more than any other I can think of in the past few years. Mm. He had an enormous impact.
And what about when there are massively unanswered questions? I mean, Michael Jackson springs to mind here, where, you know, there was a court case, but nothing was ever pinned to him. You know, you type his name into a search engine, one of the first things you're going to see are questions about child abuse, and yet, unassailable musical legend, there's an incredible story there about, you know, child through to teenager through to pop star. How much emphasis do you give something like that, which, you know, maybe in 50 years time might be the story but isn't now?
Well, I think it's a big obituary, and that's a complex obituary as well. You cover the music and the huge impact of his music, but you also tell the story of this troubled life, and I think it's you don't hold back. You give the whole story. And I think if you look at the archive, there are some obituaries that you'd actually like to write again. Jimmy Savile is a classic example, mm, where the obit was a great tribute to him, to his charitable work, held him up in high esteem. And if you go to the library and look at it, you think, my goodness, we got that wrong. Everyone got it wrong. But it does make you think. The obituary is not necessarily the last word.
I mean, obviously, we're talking pretty much in the shadow of Martin McGuinness having just died. I mean, yeah, there's an example of someone who I imagine their obituary has changed dramatically over the past two decades.
Yes. I mean, we wouldn't have written an obituary until relatively recently, I don't think, until he entered the political... There's a lot of argument over who deserves an obituary and who doesn't deserve an obituary. And again, I think that's changing, and in the sense that if somebody had a major impact on society, in one way or another, for good or for bad, we will cover them. And clearly McGuinness became a quite significant figure over the past 15 years.
But I mean, I pick that example because not only is it recent, but also what's going on politically in Ireland at the moment is a live situation. So I imagine almost his obituary would have been different if it were written 2 months ago than if it were written now.
Yes, it was updated on the day of publication, because of events in Northern Ireland, and they're ongoing. The question is, where do you stop? And I don't think an obituary is actually about necessarily bringing you right up to the hour. It's the story of a life. It's not the story of events. Mm. And sometimes obituaries, I think, get confused. They tell you an awful lot about a great event and less about the person involved.
And then there are the very notable people who die very suddenly and no one expected them to.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of example. I mean, obviously George Michael was recent, although he'd had trouble with drugs in the past. I guess you had something.
We did have it. With figures like that, we commission all the time. I mean, last week we were having a look at Kirk Douglas turned 100 recently, so we had a good check through him.
It's a good bet.
You know, we heard some considerable time ago that John Hurt had cancer. His obit was written and up to date. And Clive James has been very ill for a long time, and he seems to have lived a great deal longer than people expected him, or he himself expected.
Yeah, much to his own
and has written a great deal since we had his obituary rewritten a couple of years ago. And so that's is being updated all the time. But sometimes we're caught out. Gene Wilder died late last year. And we hadn't got a strong obit on him at all. And we had to wait a day, which was absolutely infuriating because the Telegraph did have a good one. They put it up online and we were a day behind. It does happen. It happens to them. It happens to us. I think that's the way it goes sometimes. But you're always aware of commissioning those people, really prominent people. We do try to make sure we've got good obits in the style we want, ready to go.
So even if they're relatively young and nothing in their career suggests that they are about to have a tragic accident.
Yeah, I mean, we do. There are, I mean, certainly we commissioned Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton at the start of the American election campaign. We've even, during Brexit, we commissioned Nigel Farage. You never quite know what happens, what's coming next. And so we're very aware, and we are commissioning all the time. I mean, sometimes there are quite funny consequences. I think some years ago we were doing an obit of the American writer Bill Bryson, who happened to be worked for the Times at one stage or another. And so we got a rumour that he had taken out British citizenship. And my colleague, he was a chap called Andrew Riley, had phoned Bryson's agent and said, look, can I speak to you in complete confidence? We're doing a stock obit on Bill Bryson. Can you tell us whether he took out British citizenship or not? And the agent had said, OK, well, look, I'll try to find out for you and I'll get back tomorrow. And the following day, Andrew got a call. And it was Bill Bryson. And he said, I want you to know that I am still an American citizen. I haven't taken out British citizenship. As it happens, I'm writing a feature for the Times at the moment, and I hope to goodness my article appears long before yours.
Has anyone ever asked to read their obituary?
No. I have had people ringing up asking if we'd be interested in writing their obituary while they're still alive. And we have interviewed people directly for their obituary, but it doesn't happen very often.
That's a fascinating interview. People must be prepared to say things that they know are only going to be published after they've died.
Yes.
That they wouldn't say when they're alive.
Well, I think there are some newspapers, particularly in America, which have done video obits. And it's a chance for the subject maybe to say things which they wouldn't normally say in the normal run of things. But we tried with a handful of people to see if they'd be interested in doing a video bits, a sort of video testimony. And we haven't had any takers yet. We had a couple who put us on hold and said they'd think about it and get back to us. But the majority just said no.
Have you ever had to write an obituary of someone you know?
Yes, I have. I have. There was a friend who died last year who was an architect who I knew a lot about. And I think that was quite difficult.
Must be hard to write in the sort of clinical journalistic style about someone you're emotionally involved with.
It is. And I didn't actually write the obituary. I handed it over to someone else and gave them a lot of information. I think it's very difficult sometimes to... I don't think you necessarily should write the obituaries about people you're very close to. I think you have to take a stand back and give it to someone who can perhaps be more objective.
That was Simon Pearson. Thank you to him. That interview was recorded originally for my other podcast series, The Modern Man. You can find that and many of the other interviews that we've done for that show at modernman.co.uk. That's it for today. Thank you to Simon, Phoebe and Mivan, and to you for listening. This episode is dedicated to Andy Winter, who works at a students' union and says, Ollie, can you big up our student media groups, URN Radio, Impact Magazine and NSTV. Consider it done. Andy, thank you for your support. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and the Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time, bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.